From our lunch break, we're going to start with the agenda item of item I, the California Case Management System status update and a demonstration. And we have Justice Berniers, who is chair of the CCMS Executive Committee, presenting with others, and he'll introduce his panel. Thank you, Justice Berniers.
Chief Justice, members of the council, good afternoon. I'm Terry Berniers. I'm an Associate Justice on the First District Court of Appeal, and I've been asked to chair the Executive Committee of our new CCMS governance structure. As you're all aware, we have recently established a more broadly inclusive and robust governance structure, in part in an effort to address the criticisms raised in the recent Bureau of State Audits report that there have been failures in project management and oversight and a failure to adequately foster acceptance by our trial courts for implementation of the system. Our committee includes judges and court executive officers from 27 trial courts. We recently held the initial meeting of the governance committees in San Francisco on January 31st and February 1st and had what I think were very productive initial meetings. I think it's fair to say that the sharp criticisms contained in the BSA report have caused serious concerns within our branch and in our legislature about our ability to manage, complete, and implement an effort that I believe is essential to our ability to operate as a coherent and coordinated judicial branch. One critic referred to it as a crisis of confidence, and I cannot disagree with that assessment. That means our first priority as the Governance Committee has been to attempt to restore confidence both within and outside the branch in what we are doing and how we are doing it. We've attempted to assure our colleagues that the issues raised by the audit have been and are being adequately addressed and that we will have a management process and oversight that is fully transparent and accountable. As I recently said at a joint legislative committee hearing, I think it's important going forward to note that there are really three issues we need to look at in this project: our purpose, our process, and our product. I think it's also important to remember that only one of these, our process, has been brought into question by the auditor's report. Our purpose is and has been to move beyond the myriad systems we inherited from an era of local trial court funding and support and to develop a system that links our courts together, a system that provides better access to the public to court information and court services, and which provides critical and meaningful information to judges, local court administrators, and to our justice partners. That purpose has been endorsed and supported over the past 10 years by three governors, by the State Chief Information Officer, by the legislature, by the Judicial Council, and by our former and present Chief Justices. That goal, that purpose, has not been questioned either by the Chief Information Officer, now the Chief the Technology Office, or by the Bureau of State Audits. As you've just heard, we have completed the recommended cost-benefit analysis, which confirms the tangible economic benefits we can derive from implementation of CCMS. And that report, as you also heard, does not even attempt to quantify the qualitative benefits that will be derived from unprecedented levels of public access to court services and court information, and the economic benefits that the bar will derive from things like e-filing. We believe we have now developed a product, and you'll see a demonstration in a few moments, that will fully justify the investment we have made, which will meet the needs of our trial courts, and which will provide far better service to the public than we are able to provide now. We've agreed to add an independent third-party verification process while we simultaneously conduct our own acceptance testing to ensure that this claim will have credibility. In a moment, our new project management officer, Mark Moore, will explain the product's acceptance testing that is now underway, and you will see a live demonstration of what version 3 of the system is doing in our courts today and the promise that V4 has once it is fully accepted and implemented, as it will be shortly. As to our process, We've already said that we accept all of the recommendations of the Bureau of State Audits, and we've already implemented virtually all of them, or will have them implemented very shortly. As the chair of the Governance Committee, I'm committed to keeping the branch and this council informed of what we're doing at all times, to make timely recommendations to you about what we think our next steps should be, and to be available to respond to your questions at any time. And I'd be happy to take your questions this morning, although it might be helpful if you can hear from Mark Moore and perhaps see some of the demonstrations here first. So I'll leave that up to you. Unless there are any immediate questions you would like me to answer, I'd like to introduce Mark Moore, who is the designated project management officer for CCMS.
Good afternoon, and thank you for your time this afternoon. I wanted to spend a little, just a short period of time to bring the council up to date on the product acceptance testing, which I'll get into in a minute, but all of the other testing that CCMS has undergone to get to this point where we're actually now 70-plus branch representatives in there every day exercising test scripts. I will also talk about...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. A bit of the fact that I'm deaf. Could you just move your microphone?
Sure. Is that better? It is? Okay, great. Sorry about that. I'm also going to take a moment at the end to address a couple of questions that I've been asked on several occasions recently, and they're almost exactly the same every time they're asked, so I thought they must be on everyone's mind, so I'll just share those questions and answers with you and maybe follow-up dialogue if you want after that. First of all, the scope of the development. As you know, that there are two parts to CCMS. There's the core product, and the core product simply is all the functionality required to process all the case types throughout the life of a case, from initiation to calendaring, judicial officer processes and interaction, clerk processes and interaction, court operations staff in the back office, in the front office, at the window dealing with the public, minute orders, fees, forms, notices, and reports. The application comes with two standard configurations. The first configuration is what I would call a generalized configuration, and that generalized configuration supports smaller courts where you have a universal a small group of individuals who have to perform multiple functions. And then there's a specialized configuration that supports multiple complex work queues for medium and larger size courts that actually split the work up and actually have specialized processors who interact with the casework there. It should be noted that those two standard configurations in every case in deployment will require some minor modifications to accommodate work processes, workflows, fees, and fines that are specific and bail enhancements that are specific to your court. So that's the starting point. You can think of that as maybe 80% of the job, and then the remaining configuration for your particular court would be 20%. Then we have the external components, and those are the 125 data exchanges that you've heard about that were developed to national standards that are available for all the local and statewide justice partners to be able to hook their systems up and interact with CCMS. There's also a web portal that it has a public face, and it also has a justice partner face, and based upon the roles of the individuals and connection they have to particular cases, whether that information is public, it would be accessible to the public. But if you're an individual, a lawyer, and you have an interest or you're a party in a particular case, you'll be able to see the specifics of your case through that portal. And then a statewide data warehouse, which is going to collect all the information for the case, and it's going to be our knowledge center that will really allow courts through 80 standard reports to be able to get all sorts of information about not just their court, but to the extent that the courts want to share information or do trend analysis, GIPSA statistics, for instance, that whole GIPS's process will be part of the statewide data warehouse and will be supported by those reports. For those of you who want to have individual reports, management reports, and do business analysis, you will be able to do that. And there is a tool that comes with this that allows your individual folks to go in and actually design their own management reports, or with some help from us, if you'd like, create specialized reports for your court. And then there, lastly, there's a migration utility, and that migration utility just helps for folks who have V2 and V3 transition to the new system. So think of it as a conversion in a box, which will help us. Now that the testing phases, I will go very briefly through those four testing phases, but I want to note from the beginning, there is a testing phase missing that is very, very important, and that's called the stress testing that we've gone through and we continue to go through on a periodic basis. And stress testing, at the CCTC, we have built out a CCMS environment that replicates the size and complexity of the end state deployment of CCMS. And then we are applying transaction volumes to that system that will imitate or mimic what we expect at the peak volume when we are totally deployed. And we have a whole series of performance metrics that we've established with participating courts that participate in the design and development. And they have to, and you can think of those as service levels that need to be met during peak periods. And we have exercised the application and proven to ourselves that the application meets at the tech center those agreed upon performance metrics. And after significant changes are made to the system, we will periodically redo those stress testings to make sure that as the system is changed or modified, that we haven't done anything to degrade the performance of the system. So I just wanted to briefly tell you that. The design validation testing, for those of you who have court staff and subject matter experts who have been participating, we refer to that as the deep dive. It is really a fine-tooth comb where you go through the 4,300 individual work units that are screen functions, actions, forms, notices. It's on the slide there, and we test every single one of those. And we go through a process called find, fix, and validation. That means find any defects in those 4,300 individual work units, fix them, which involves an analysis, and then a design of a resolution to the problem, then the fix, and then the validation of it is to go through the retesting of that. This occurred from October of last year and completed in February, and it really what the real benefit of this is that we not only make sure that the system is operating appropriately and isn't breaking and you aren't running into errors that are preventing you from going through a workflow process, but when an end user actually goes in and starts to use the system, it will operate exactly as we directed that it should be through that 17,000 pages of requirements. So that was what's involved. We actually had to map all those 4,300 work units and then map them to that 17,000 page final functional design to make sure there'd be no gaps. And that activity was the responsibility of the Deloitte team under general supervision of the SRO at that time, the Burbank office, and now under my team's direction. Then we have, it's kind of a strange term, it's called string testing. Think of it as the next level of complexity. So in the validation, you just looked at the individual work units and said, oh, yes, that field works right, it's displayed right, the screen is set up appropriately, the fields are where we believe they should be, and they make sense. Now we actually start to integrate and combine those processes to do a particular function. And that we take those 4,300 items, and in the core, we distill them down to 324 use cases and exercise those. And for the 121 data exchanges and the 83 reports, we'll do the same thing. And again, the objective is to try to get through a series of processes in a more complex set of circumstances and see if things break along the way. And then you do the same fix, find the fix, and the validation approach for that and get through that. That was done in parallel with the deep dive. So as we would complete the validation testing, we would begin for that particular section and that team to then start the string testing. And so that started and finished roughly in the same period of time. Integration testing is, think of that as the next level of complexity. And this, the objective of this for an application vendor like Deloitte is to add all the complexity, go through 11,000 particular test scripts to test from beginning to end a case initiation, producing a form, going through a set of workflow processes to actually get an end result. It is the most complex part of testing, and Deloitte's objective in meeting this is to actually have as close to a production-ready system as possible, because when they exit this phase, which they did this month, then we, the branch, get an opportunity to do our product acceptance testing, which is very much the same as this testing. And again, it's 11,054 scripts on the external components. It's going to be 8,574, almost 8,600. And the exit criteria, this is very important because we want it to be production ready, is the same exit criteria that we, the branch, are using in order to accept that application. And that's what we call 0050. Zero, the two first zeros are severity level one. Think of those as showstoppers, roadblocks. If you have an error of that classification, you just can't move forward with the test. It's very severe and would be very disruptive. There can be none of those. Level two, you could probably complete your test and look at the other results, but you can't get from the beginning of the process to the end of the process. And so those need to be fixed, too, before you go into production. And then 50 severity level 3 defects are impactful defects, but they're defects that aren't preventing us from completing the workflow. In many cases, we can develop workarounds while we fix them. And just because we would exit in this criteria doesn't mean that Deloitte would not repair those 50 rejects. It just means that they're of a quantity that we can consider the product acceptable. We went through three cycles of that integration test, Deloitte did. And something we did that was unique in this process is we had a subset of our testers who were available shadow Deloitte and repeat these tests, which you typically don't do. But what the advantage of that was that we were able to follow right on top of what the Deloitte testers were doing and see, did it break in the same way? Did we have the same findings? Did we find things they didn't find? When we found errors, did we think they were severe as they did? And the real benefit is not only did we get trained on this, but we made sure there was no difference in an outside party who really doesn't understand court processes other than what's in that documentation. So they might interpret an error in a different way. We actually had real live court users following behind them, and the gaps, there were gaps, and there were opportunities to look and to train the testers to understand and have more of a court mindset when they were doing the testing, and we learned how to interact with the test scripts as well and to analyze the results. And where we believed that there were ambiguities in the 17,000-page test requirements, we were able to have a discussion on a separate track and eliminate those misunderstandings and come to an agreement before we get into product acceptance testing and have that sort of a debate going on. And then this is what we entered 2 weeks ago now, was product acceptance testing. Again, it follows. It's the same level of complexity as the integration testing. Same exit criteria, same number of scripts. Typically, it's just one cycle and a pass-through with mini cycles for when you do a find and a fix. And so what will happen is as we go through these scripts and we find errors, they're classified 1, 2, 3, and 4. They go into a development work queue. Deloitte does the repair, and then we collect them, and they deliver a patch, and they basically fix the system, and then we go in and do a more narrow cycle where we test what they've changed, as well as maybe some regression testing where we believe there might be some related problems to make sure nothing broke and as a result of the fix. I'd like to share with you as of today, as of last week, we were 3 weeks ahead of schedule. with a 97% pass rate. As of today, we are 5 weeks ahead of schedule with a 97% pass rate in most of the classifications. The importance there is that even though we have one pass with Deloitte's support, we are going to have another pass. So we are going to have another pass to be able to focus in on areas that we believe are most complex and most important to us. So we're going to have a whole second cycle of testing during our product acceptance testing that we wouldn't have. And it's really to the credit not only of Deloitte with this deep dive that they did, but our teams and your teams that have participated in making sure that the testing was accurate in these prior phases and that the test scripts were of a high quality and easily understandable, and the automation that both sides have put in to allow us to automate the more routine test scripts and spend more time looking at the results and less time actually interacting in a system where that really wasn't impactful. So that's the product acceptance testing. The next few slides, and I'm not going to go through them, and this presentation is available, but it gives you a feel for what the duration of each one of the test cycles were for both the core product, and then I've got a slide for the external components. The number of work units, just think about that as the discrete sections of work that had to be accomplished. Where you see NA on the pass rate, it's because it's behind us. Just so you know, they were staffed to a 60% pass rate. They, through those other two scenarios, they increasingly were above that. They were about at 80%, which means that they had more than enough developers to jump on problems and to work on other items like test scripts and improving those. The number of testers that Deloitte had, so that was Deloitte staff. And when you get into product acceptance testing, you see our staff and the development. Very large commitment on the part of Deloitte with staff to be appropriately staffed to not only develop quality product but to address and deliver high-quality fixes, which is very important. Every time they deliver a fix, when we do the regression testing, they get better. That's very important. So they're getting more intelligent even as they're fixing, which is very encouraging. On external components, I won't go through that. Again, those are just time frames. And then I've got a couple of questions that have been asked, and I'll ask them and then pause. I think Ron has some comments he wants to make.
Before we move on to those, let me just interject one thing, and I think it's important to remember as well, and it's one of the reasons that the development cycle has taken us as long as it has, is that the user requirements that we're testing for, the functionality we're testing for now, have all been court-defined. These have been defined by judges. They've been defined by court managers. They've been defined by court staff. I think we've had probably over 300 people involved in this development process over the years. So the product that we are testing now, the functionality we're testing for, originated not from the developer, but these are our user requirements as we have defined them.
Thank you. One question that's come up on – I'm sorry.
Where it says – and I don't have my glasses, unfortunately. I think it says 120 testers. Is that – who are those people and who do they work for?
Which one are you referring to? Which column?
I can't see it.
The last column?
On number of testers in the last column. It depends on which test you're talking about. In the design and validation and the string testing, you're talking about Deloitte. Folks, integration testing, you're talking about Deloitte folks. We didn't put the people we had shadowing on there. And for the product acceptance testing, that's us. And in external components, you'll see 60.
Well, who is us?
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's the judicial branch. So it is judicial officers. It is court staff. It is professional testers who bring a different discipline and viewpoint. And it is AOC employees as well. Involved in that test. So it is a judicial branch-wide effort. And when we get into external components, it will broaden. There are several state agencies who have stepped up, and they're actually going to want to test right out of the gate their interfaces. They're pretty excited about it. So this will broaden when we get into external components this summer, and we'll have some participation there as well. So any other questions? I apologize. I just started launching into that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. One question that's come up on several occasions recently is a question that was really asked at the legislative meeting, and that's what would it mean, or what's the harm in just putting a pause on CCMS and doing the independent review of the CCMS application and then assessing that and moving forward? And so I'd like to share with you, because that's a fair question, what some of the implications that should be thought about as we do that. First of all, there are contractual implications in putting a pause on the project because of where we are right now. Any delay that the judicial branch imposes on Deloitte, in other words, we're stopping because we would like to, we would have to pay Deloitte their reasonable out-of-pocket costs as they sort of wind down their staff. So they're committed to minimizing those, but they're kind of fully staffed and going full guns now. So as they turn down and until we tell them to completely stop, it's about $1 million a week at this point because of where we are at the project that we'd be responsible for. There's also hosting charges of several hundred thousand dollars a month for development environments that Deloitte has established on our behalf, and we're paying them to host, as well as at the tech center where we have a stress test environment and that product acceptance testing environment. Can we minimize those costs? We certainly could, but it would take some time for us to do that, and they wouldn't go away completely. So there would be several hundred thousand dollars a month while we were waiting for that as well. There are also staffing implications that I think should be considered. Deloitte has, as the slide shows there, over 200 staff that they would, to minimize their out-of-pocket expenses, would either reassign or let go. Release from employment, and those folks most likely would be gone permanently. And when we restarted, we would have to re-baseline with a new team that would have to come up to speed, and we would have a heavy learning curve there. I'm not saying, and I don't believe that Deloitte would want to minimize that impact, but it would be unavoidable. It would be a substantial impact to us. We also have AOC. We have professional staffers. We also have several contract staff, as well as individual AOC folks participating in this effort. Those folks would either be reassigned or they'd be released as well. The courts have over 60 subject matter experts, in some cases 70. We pay reasonable costs for those folks. If we couldn't pay them, and if they didn't have testing to do, they would be released to their normal duties, and we would maybe get them back, maybe not. There might be different folks as well, so there'd be restartup costs there. And then in deployment, we've got three early adopter courts who've stepped up. They've completed an assessment. We're working collaboratively to plan what that means for them, working with our new governance committees and trying to craft a deployment plan that's successful and meets our budgeting constraints and ensures their success. If we put a pause on that, I'm not exactly sure. I'll need them to speak for themselves on that, but I would imagine there would be some impacts for them that they would have to consider and having been stopped and then restarted, especially many of them with systems that are on the brink. We have two counties, Sonoma and Nevada, with failing systems. I'm sure one of our activities that Justice Bernays has asked me to look into is surveying other courts to find out, maybe get ahead of the curve and say, you know, for the next 3 years, how many of you really think your systems could all of a sudden go on you so that we could get a little bit more of a forecast. If we got a delay, that just moves everything down and forces them maybe to augment their systems in a way they'd rather not do, buy new systems and acquire. And there are 21 smaller courts, Graham alluded to that, that completed a study because they are now believing that CCMS may be further out in the horizon than they were originally planning, and they're really struggling on what they need to do collectively to be successful and keep their courts running. So what I'm trying to say there is a delay just moves everything. It's not just the restart costs and the out-of-pocket costs. You really start to think strategically as a branch, what does this mean for you? Because in many cases, we can't wait much longer without buying new systems individually and by default going into that path that Graham talked about. And then if I could, just one more question that came, and that was on the financials. Specifically, there's been a lot of interest in what, because of the current fiscal conditions we're in, this year, how much, what is the development budget for CCMS, for V4 CCMS? And that is $25.4 million. Of that, today, I can tell you that 5.1 million has been spent. 3.7 million has actually cleared the system, meaning I can go to Oracle and see the report and see the individual line items. There's 1.4 million in invoices that are somewhere in the process of being approved, going to the state controller that will eventually hit Oracle. Will we go over budget, or what's the likelihood that we're going to go over budget this year? I can say confidently we will not go over budget. It is my commitment to try to get under budget this year and to try to absorb the cost of the independent review without going over budget. And I'm working very closely with Judge Herman, who chairs the administrative committee, and with Justice Berniers to give them a deep dive on the budget and to give them more visibility so that they can then communicate or give me direction on the appropriate communication tool and the frequency to the council and to Bill and to Ron. With that, I'll pause, and I think Ron has some things he'd like to say.
Thank you, Mark. Just a couple of things on reporting and oversight issues of CCMS, including the BSA audit that just came out this month. We have been directed and have submitted cost reports to the legislature since the beginning of this project. So there has been ongoing annual reports, and the legislature has changed, you know, how they would like their reports organized and what they would like them to be and whatnot. But there have been annual reports to the legislature since the beginning of this process in the development of CCMS. In addition to that, we've had a number of hearings, both in budget hearings, budget-related hearings, where we have been questioned about CCMS and given information on the background of it, the purpose of it, the status of it, where we were in terms of costs in budget hearings going forward. And then in October 2009, with the establishment and the assembly of an accountability committee, we had a hearing that focused on CCMS in October of 2009 that was probably the most in-depth inquiry by the legislature that that we've had, and resulted in first the study that was done by the OCIO and released in April of 2010, in which Ms. Takai offered 20 recommendations. Every one of them has now been implemented. They included the establishment of this governing system that Justice Berniers is chair of, included the project management office and the project management office director, which is Mark's position, as well as a number of other recommendations, again, that have all been implemented at this time. There was also a request for the Bureau of State Audits to conduct the audit that I just referred to. We requested that those not be ongoing at the same time so that we were able to focus on one, and that the results of the OCIO audit might be of use to the BSA audit going forward. And so they did not run at the same time. We received the OCIO report in October of 2010, in April of 2010, and began meeting with them on a monthly basis. And those meetings continue now, so that we're working closely with them and involving them in the process going forward. After their report came out, the BSA audit began. And as you know, was just released on the 8th of February. As the Chief Justice indicated at the beginning of this meeting, we take this audit very, very seriously. It's very critical of the process that we used, and we take that criticism very seriously, and we'll take it to heart, and we will follow each of the recommendations in the audit report going forward. There was one sort of late add-on recommendation that the auditor had that she discussed with us before the report came out, and that was to do the independent review
of the system once it's completed, and make sure that it's of a quality that we would expect it to be. Our initial response to that, our reaction to that was, with the exit criteria that Mark just went through, with the 0050 defects as being a very, very high standard of review, and the number of test scripts and the rigorous testing that was going on, that we didn't initially feel it was necessary to do that kind of review after the project was completed, with an expense of $500,000 to $600,000, and not wanting to have a delay in the process. That being said, given the criticism and the critique of the audit itself and the concerns that it raised, clearly that is a process that we agree now should be done in any event. We're confident in what the outcome will be, but we're supportive of that as well. So, again, we're taking this audit very, very seriously and taking it to heart. We're following each and every one of the recommendations, and we'll benefit from the recommendations going forward. One of the things that was not said in this audit or in the OCIO report was that the system doesn't work, or the system's no good. And the fact of the matter is, the system does work, and the system is very good. And that's one of the things we wanted to be able to show you today with Judge Moss and Judge Reeser, in terms of showing you exactly what the system looks like and how it will work.
Okay. Judge Moss, who uses the system in his court on a daily basis, who can show you what it's doing for us today.
All right, good afternoon. Glad to be here. I know most of you. My name is Bob Moss. Judge Jackson suggested I do this in a British accent to have more credibility. I'm not going to do that. I'm a member of the council, as most of you know. I'm also on the new executive committee for CCMS. But more importantly, I'm a trial judge, and my current assignment is in civil. And I work in Orange County. In Orange County, probably all of you know, it's a big county compared to all of them except for Los Angeles. We're the third largest in the state. We have a population of over 3 million people. We have 117 judges, 35 commissioners. I think we have 7 separate courthouses. Pretty big operation. We started with V3, the interim version of CCMS, 3 years ago. We were one of the first courts to go on. I was listening to Mr. Finley talk about what to expect when you deploy a new system, and I was nodding my head because we went through that early period where we had people on every floor, the clerks weren't sure how to use it. It didn't take us a year. I would say maybe 6 months before the complaints kind of tapered off. I can report to you now, I spoke just a few weeks ago to the chief of our civil operations, and she told me we're getting virtually no complaints from clerks. I'm the chair of our court technology committee, and we're getting no complaints from judges. I'm sure you can find judges who don't like it, who don't like computers, who don't like this program. I'm sure you can find clerks, but we're using it every single day in 48 courtrooms in Orange County. Now, this version, as you probably know, is an interim version. It doesn't handle all case types, just civil, small claims, mental health, and probate. So it's kind of limited in its application. But what I'm going to do is show you what it looks like, because I think a picture may be worth 1,000 words. And if everything goes according to plan, I'll push this button, and we should log into the system. There we go. Now, this is not a demo. This is not a fake screen. This is my bench back in Orange County. We're connected over the Internet. This is my real calendar today that I'm not attending to. If you look here, there's a set of these dark blue tabs across the top. Case, accounting, calendar, courtroom. These are all the different functions that different people in the courthouse use. Accounting, obviously. The clerk uses the courtroom tab. The only tab a judge really has to use is the judicial officer tab. Now, the clerk and her version of V3 does not have a judicial officer tab, so she can't use my screen. Only the judges can do that. Initially, when V3 was developed, we thought we'd have two views. You can see over on the left we have a chamber view and a bench view, and I'll get to case search in a little bit. We've learned that the idea was you're working in your office, you need a different view than when you're on the bench, and we learned you really don't need the two different views. So in V4 that Glenn is going to show you, we've done away with the two views, and I won't even bother with the chamber view now. But this is what I see up on my bench or in my office. This little box right here, this light blue box I'm kind of circling with the cursor, is a simple little widget. It's a calendar calculator. It'll tell you 15 court days from today. That's the date if you're setting a hearing. If you want to set something for 45 days, you just type it in right there. It'll give you, it's just a handy little widget for judges to have on the bench. I think you can all see that. Over to the right is an active calendar. We've seen these on all kinds of programs. If you click on this little guy here, it'll take you to the next 2 months and so forth. Down below, you'll see when a judge opens up his or her calendar, it defaults to your department. So I'm in Department C23 in our Central Justice Center in Santa Ana. And if I wanted to look at another judge's courtroom, however, I would just scroll up here. If a supervising judge wanted to see what was going on in a different courtroom, you can easily scroll to any other department that is using this system. Down below, this is the day view, and this shows you my calendar. We call these little items buckets, and you can set V3 to allow for a limited number of summary judgments. You can set the size of your bucket so that automatically when you start to calendar hearings, your bucket will be filled up. It'll go to the next calendar date. So that's a handy tool to have. Like every program you've operated, if you want to see what's in that bucket, you just click on the little plus sign there. Don't go slow. There we go. And you'll see in that bucket just one motion. It's a motion for summary judgment. And if you want to look at the case file, you simply click on the link to the case, and there you go. And this is real time. This is the speed with which I'm 800 miles away from Orange County. This is the speed with which I can operate it remotely. If anything, it's a little faster in our courtroom where it's hardwire connected. This is the first, when you drill down into a case, you get the case summary sheet. This gives you some quick information, of course, the case number and the name of the case, the type of case, a little case description. It's a breach of contract case. We want to know, is trial set or not set? That's something trial judges need to know at hearings. This trial is set in this case. The case age, all of you, please don't look. It's 708 days old. It probably was up on appeal.
Several.
That's my excuse. It'll tell you the last event date is here and the next event date. So just some quick, easy information. If we scroll down on this screen, it'll tell you what future events are set. In this case, we have a jury trial is the only future event that is set. You can look, if you're in a probate case, you can look at probate notes. In a civil case or any other case where you use tentative decisions, you can see your tentative rulings down there. Now, in this, in Orange County, we don't use V3's tentative ruling functionality. And it's not that it doesn't work. I know that Glenn uses it in Ventura. He'll tell you they use it. It works fine. But we already had a system to put our tentative rulings on the Internet already. We use a widget that we created for Word. So we didn't change that. And one of the good things about V3 is it's configurable. That is, you can switch functionality on and off that you want to use or don't use. So it's very handy in that respect. But we don't use that functionality. But you can see if you want tentative rulings and things like that. Case milestones and other things. Let's see. And you can print this sheet if you want to have a hard copy of it. Let me take you over. On the left here is the menu of things you can select from. Let's go to case notes. I'll show you case notes. If a judge wants to make notes in the case, you simply click on that little icon, and you can. I'm not going to create a note here because this is a live file, but you click on Create New. If I had made case notes, you'd see them listed, and we have security levels so a judge can set a note that only that judge can see, only all judges can see, anybody can see. You can set the level of security on case notes that you make. Now, personally, I don't put case notes in my cases. I keep them. I have separate files in Word where I have my jury instructions and other things. I just have it all set up that way. But if I chose to, I could keep case notes on this file. So then you just create that note, and it's all there. It's typed in, and it's a great reference if you choose to use that functionality. Let's go to Register of Actions. Let's say you want to see that complaint. You click on Register of Actions, and you'll see this list of pleadings here. If it has a little icon with a paper and pencil, that means there's an image document that you can access and look at. And Mr. Finley was talking about a document management system. You have to have a document management system to access the image of the document this way. Orange County, before I was on board, had the foresight to start imaging documents like 10 or 12 years ago. So we have this vast library of pleadings that we can access. If your court doesn't do that, that's something I recommend you get on right away so that you can have this functionality, because this makes all the difference in the world. So let's go down. I'll just pick a document at random. Doesn't matter what it is. I'll just pick this one. Click on that, and you can look at the pleading, scroll through it, read it. If counsel references a paragraph, you can get right to it that way. And you just get out of it just like that. And you can go back up to your bench view. The other, so that's basically it. I mean, you can see your calendar. You can access your file. You can look at documents in your file. The other functionality is if you don't you want to see a case that's not on your calendar that day, you just open up case search. If you know the case number, you type it in, and it will find that case for you. And you can do the same things I just showed you with that case. If you don't know the case number and you remember the case name or some of these parameters you can see described here, you fill in those blanks and you can go right to that case. And you can also do that up here. You know, like Microsoft, there's 100 ways to do the same thing. You can type in a case number up here or the old legacy number if you want and go to a case to look at the documents in that case. So from a judge's standpoint, that's really what we use it for. And I like to remind people, this V3 and V4, these are really not primarily judges' tools. These are tools for the court, the clerk's office, to manage documents, enter minutes, and keep the record of your case. So it's the judges don't use it that much. Now, a judge can create a document in V3. If I want to create a tentative ruling or a ruling, an order or a judgment, I can do it, but frankly, I don't. What I do is I type it out in Word, email it to my clerk, and my clerk enters the rulings into the system. Okay. I think that's the essential functionality of V3. I don't want to belabor this. Am I forgetting anything? Yeah, Jim.
Well, first of all, Alan and I were, since you're 800 miles from Orange County and we're only 400 miles, we were wondering if you were a hologram.
I want to beam back because tomorrow I'm the best man in Dave McKechnie's wedding, so I have to get back.
Bob, but what do you take on the bench with you?
I have a computer in my chambers.
I actually had a question.
He had the floor. I'm sorry. You'll have to wait.
Say you're an analog judge trapped in a digital hell, and you, this is all fine, but you've got a case and you want some paper to work with. How does Orange County work with that?
Well, I didn't mention this, and I should. I'll get to answer your question in a second. Last July, think about this. We threw away all of our civil paper files. Threw them away. We shredded them. We don't have paper files in civil anymore. And we don't miss it a bit. And you think, oh, my God, how can I do law and motion without looking at the complaint, the demur, the opposition? What we do is, if a judge wants, we will print off that paper. It's cheaper for us to print the paper for those motions, let the judge scribble on it and make notes and read them, take them home if he wants or she wants, and then we shred them right after that and recycle the paper. It's cheaper for us to do that. We had 11 people whose job it was, when Judge Moss called down for a file, to go find the file, if they could find it, because it might be in legal research or it might be in another department, put it on a cart with all the other carts, take it to the elevator, go down the floors, dropping off files, and then picking them up and taking them back. 11 people we have reassigned to other jobs. Nobody's lost their job. They actually have better jobs, better opportunities, but we don't have to have people. And Mr. Finley was talking about when you save money, when you go paperless, that's what he meant. We save real estate, and we save bodies not doing that kind of work. So the judge who wants paper can have all the paper he or she wants. That's the answer to your question, Jim. And the skinny files that we create, the little paper files with just the pleadings you want, it's better than that big construction defect case that has five folders, you know, with tons of documents in them to dig through. It's much easier for even the paper reading judges. And I was down in San Diego doing a demo down there, and I showed this one wonderful elderly judge, I forget his name, and he just hates computers. He doesn't like them, doesn't want to use them, and that's fine. My father-in-law doesn't have a cell phone even. But I told him, I reassured him, you don't need to like computers because Your clerk can print your calendar for you, and your clerk can print off the pleadings you want to see. It's no problem. You can have all the paper you want. He was happy. Now, to answer Justice Bernier's question, it was...
What you take on that? I think you answered
on the
answer.
Bench.
What you take
yeah.
on the bench with you?
On the bench, I have a laptop computer. It's in my backpack back at the hotel, and I keep that in chambers, and I actually have a mechanical connection. There's a switch that if I hit the space bar in my chambers, my monitor on my desk will light up, and I can use that keyboard and monitor. On the bench, I have a separate monitor and keyboard that's linked to my laptop. So my computer stays in chambers, but I can access everything on my computer from the bench. And I have this screen that you're looking at up there. If counsel mentions a document, I can call up that document. And I'm not going to talk about other programs that we have in Orange County, but we have something called ELF that is a little more user-friendly, getting to several pleadings at once, and I'll often run that instead of V3. But it accesses the V3 database, so you can't have ELF without V3. And, of course, we'll give away ELF to anybody who has V3. We also have our pleadings, one more thing, that are published on the Internet. So that's the other way you have to close that circle. You have to get your documents on the Internet so that people can access the file. Lawyers and court users can access those pleadings, but you have to have the document management system so you have the electronic images so you can post them on the Internet. And we actually receive revenues now from those people downloading those documents. It's terrific. We receive revenue from that. And also, last year we started e-filing. And that's truly closing the circle, and Mr. Finley talked about that. With e-filing, and we have now, in this short space since, when was it, July, I think we started, Alan, was it July? E-filing, now we have 17% of our civil filings are e-filing.
Unlimited civil.
That's terrific, and our target, we're going to try to reach 50% by when?
End of the year.
Promising, right? That's our target. And what we did was we didn't just switch it on and expect lawyers to do it. We went to bar associations and did demonstrations. I took my tech guy who's sitting in the back there and some of his people, and we took our vendor who does the interface with our system, and we go around to lawyer groups, but not just lawyer groups. We went to legal secretary groups and paralegal groups and showed them how this works. And they're all jumping on board once they find out. I mean, you can file a complaint from a Starbucks in Buenos Aires, I'd like to say. And they realize they can work different hours. It's really terrific, and it's good for everybody. And we use it pretty seamlessly in Orange County. So I think that anybody who's afraid of this product, I mean, it's living proof that it works in Orange County. Yes, Bill.
How do the staff react to it, the clerks?
Well, you know, we don't hire our clerks with IT backgrounds, right? Most of them are high school graduates, and they've used paper and pen and typing. So a lot of them are a little not very oriented towards technology. And it's a new system, so it's tough when you start. My clerk is the best example. I adore her, but she's not as oriented as I am to computers. I often have to come out and show her how you do something, you know. But I asked her, and I said, don't tell me what I want to hear because you know what I want to hear. Tell me how you like the system. And she's perfectly happy with it now. Now that she's gotten used to it and she's got it as part of her routine, she wouldn't want to go back to the old system that we had. I have other clerks who are younger, more computer-oriented, and they just think V3 is terrific. They can explain to you, and I'm not a clerk, so I don't do their work, but there are ways with the most recent version of V3, we call it Release 10, you can do multiple cases at one time, the same task, and you save tons of time from a clerk standpoint doing that. So the short answer is the clerks are now used to it. I'm sure you'll find one or two that don't like it, but the vast majority are fine with it.
I had a question.
Yeah, Bert.
Now this is developed, is the funding for this system coming from your court or coming from the AOC?
I don't know. Alan?
That we run the system on our equipment in Orange, so it's our staff and our money that pays to operate it on a day-to-day basis. But the V3 software is written and maintained by the AOC, and we have exactly the same version everybody else has. We just run
so
it
that's,
on our...
So if we were to shut down everything, that would obviously affect what's going on there, right?
We have the software on our equipment. We could keep running. We'd kind of be stuck with where we are right now.
Yeah, we'd negotiate for the code. If we could get the code to V3, we'd probably just collaborate with San Diego and some other courts and just keep on doing our thing because we're not going back. Yes, sir.
You would just have civil, but you would never have any other component of the
case. Oh, yeah.
You're still short. You still have to have something at some point.
This is just in, mainly in civil. It works in probate and mental health and small claims.
You could probably buy the code and get by on civil, probate, all that.
Yeah. In my assignment, I'm fine right now with V3. It works great.
And the traffic and everything else, you would
we have a different system for criminal traffic and
yeah.
a third system for family juvenile.
Okay. But at
yeah.
some point, they would have to be replaced.
But I'll tell you the sad thing about the situation we have is I'm a civil trial judge. So if I don't have any trials and I'm open and there aren't any civil trials, I can't call family law and take a case because my clerk can't use the family law system. I can't take a criminal case because she's not trained in our criminal system, and neither am I. I mean, but it's more important that the clerk be trained. So I can't take a case from the other case types because of this limitation. That's why we need one case management system that handles all case types. Yes, sir.
You know, you just ask a question, and you said what would happen, and Ira said you'd have to buy the code. Who would you have to buy the code from?
We don't have to buy the code.
No, we wouldn't have to buy
the code. Yeah. I don't know that we would. We don't have to have the code. We have the software running on our equipment now. It could keep on running on our equipment.
But you couldn't modify it without having the knowledge transfer,
right.
Am I correct?
Right.
And you don't have the knowledge transfer.
We do a lot of things. We call them apps now. We just call them magic buttons. We put a lot of stuff, like the ELF system he talked about, is built on top of V3. It takes data from V3 and data from our document management system. We wrote all that stuff internally. We could keep writing things like that.
For example,
the system alive. We'd rather have the code.
For example, V3, and when you type an order, the editor in V3 is not full Microsoft Word. It's a lesser version of that. So if you type something in Word and cut and paste it into V3 with their editor, it's going to maybe screw up your paragraphs, things like that. But so we have an app that we figured out a way to have a full Word available to the judge who wants his or her order typed in a certain way. And it's like having a link in V3 to that document that we keep. So we invent these things to make it work better.
But it would be easier if you had the code. Is that? And why don't you?
We don't need it, really. And plus we want to have the same thing that San Diego has and Ventura has and San Luis has. Because anything we do to the system, we can give to anybody else who's got it. So we want to stay in a system where we can all share making something better down the road.
And the continuity of having the statewide system so that the information is the same up and down the state is important in terms of the venue transparency and whatnot. The maintenance and operation of V3 is done by the AOC and Deloitte and paid for. So changes in fees, updates to the product. We just mentioned release 10. So any releases, new releases, those kinds of things are done by the AOC for all of the V3 courts.
But we're very much involved in the release, release, like the e-filing release. We're the ones doing e-filing. We were there making sure the release did what we wanted to do. I mean, it was a very interactive process with the AOC people, and then we implemented it.
And that's what we're assuming from Deloitte is the maintenance and operation. You saw some news stories about us retaining consultants and that kind of thing. That's going to save us millions of dollars when we have that knowledge transfer and we have that maintenance and operation at the AOC and no longer with the vendor.
Any other comments or questions? That's about the end of the demo. Bert, did you have something?
Well, I just know that we're going to lose a couple of council members around 1:30 or so. So, and we must have some discussion.
We've got Glenn Reeser here to show you what V4 will do, and I think he can do that fairly quickly for you, so that at least you see what the product is that we are testing right now.
Okay.
Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Moss.
Distinguished members of the council, I'm here to talk to you about
the final product. Bob did a great job showing you the interim version, which we've learned a lot from. The final product, of course, is not just a court tool, but it's a public tool. It's an attorney tool. It's a justice partner tool, and it's a media tool. This is Tony Rashan, who's helping me. This is actually Tony's first voyage with me on this, so we'll learn together how navigable the final product is with Tony. In the last 146 months, I've been privileged to be able to have the opportunity to manage calendars in criminal, felony and misdemeanor trial courts, in criminal arraignment courts, in family law court, in civil trial courts and law and motion courts, in probate conservatorship courts. And I've learned over the last few years that that was just really my internship for software development. So, and as Bob mentioned, I use V3 all day, every day in my formerly civil and now probate courtroom, and I have since its inception. And I want to point out that Ventura, unlike Orange County, works seamlessly from the California Court Technology Center and provides me with the internet-based real-time data to run my calendars. And I also want to note that I'm not running this from a bunker in the Silicon Valley or in Orange County, but from a courthouse in a farm field in Oxnard. And I also think we should note that Ventura's V3 was uploaded and deployed in San Joaquin County for half the cost and half the time it took us to deploy V3 in Ventura. So I'm also, and I will continue to be, a test pilot on the final project, on the final product, and I'm going to talk about that right now. And we're going to show you the screens in sort of a reverse engineering process, starting with the public screens and then working our way down into the courthouses. But I think I need to emphasize that one of the legacies of our history as a branch is the literally hundreds of ways that information is processed in our 400 trial courthouses. And those business processes are centered and designed and have been centered and designed for far more than a century, right? On the receipt, movement, and delivery of single documents. And over the course of time, the generators of those documents have expanded, not just from the courts and the litigants, but to probation officers and to family law mediators and to probate investigators, to 730 experts, to child welfare agencies, to APS, you name it. And the ability of our courts to synchronize the delivery of multiple documents at a given point in time at a specific location in our 400 courtrooms, actually courthouses, is a logistical nightmare that we face in each of our hundreds of thousands of annual hearings every year in California. And I'm guessing when I say hundreds of thousands of hearings because we don't actually know how many hearings we have, because there's no way for our systems other than CCMS to talk to one another. So complicated by the fact, as we heard, that each county has different data entry systems for particular case types, the majority of which are old, many of which are failing, and the capability of all of those data entry systems is limited. Complicated by the fact that our justice partners, the police in the streets, the deputies at the booking station, the reception officials at CDC and CYA, the probation officers with these massive caseloads, the prosecutors who need to dispose of cases, who desperately need court information, access accurate criminal histories, street gang associations, terms and conditions of probation, restraining orders, family issues, cannot access the information they need from our court files. And so this is what does that. So after years of deployment, as Mark indicated earlier, the product is complete. It's subject to product and user acceptance testing. We designed it. We paid for it, and now we're ready to use it. So Tony has up the public portal. And this, according to Mark, will be ready to be available to the public in July of 2011. That's this year. And this is every Californian's portal to access court information. And it's designed so that the most frequent types of transactional protocols can be addressed first. So obviously traffic tickets are addressed here. Court fees and fines are addressed here. People can search calendars. For those non-registered folks, meaning the non-attorneys, can find probate notes, tentative rulings, what have you. So let's search for somebody. So a Californian would go online and basically look for a court file, look for an individual, search an attorney. And in this case, we're looking for Karen Campbell. And Karen Campbell, you will note, has a specific identifier. And so in California, this Karen Campbell has six cases of different case types, had six cases of different case types in California. And this is a criminal case that's being opened up for Karen Campbell, which gives the public a certain amount of information relating to that individual. And also, to the extent there are documents associated with that particular court file, for example, the complaint in that case, that would be available to this particular user. So individuals and the media who are frequently are accessing our file rooms and are trying to locate files which may or may not be in the file room and documents which may or may not be in the file, these will be available to the public real time. With respect to those documents which are allowed to be public documents through their California portal. Well, if you want to do citation payment, we can do citation payment, but I suggest we go to the attorney portal. Okay. So let's go to the attorney portal. And this is for registered users. So an attorney would put in typically their bar number, and there would be certain encryption involved in accessing that file. But the attorney portal that has been designed for the final product really has four components. And you see there's menu items on the left, but really the four components are, first of all, upcoming events. So that every attorney who is a participant in a California case will have hearings, trials scheduled. And those hearings, if you just scroll for a second, Tony, will be identified typically chronologically, but not necessarily here, so they'll know where they're supposed to be at a given time. It's not going to replace a paralegal or secretary, but it will certainly augment where an attorney needs to know they need to be at a given point in time. And you will see that there are hyperlinks over on the right side, which will allow the attorneys to actually open up those files real time to see, A, why they're supposed to be there, but more importantly, all the documents associated with that case, including the most recently filed documents. Then there's an attorney search feature, which relates to my cases, meaning those attorneys' cases. Third is it's their California cases. So in this case, this attorney luckily only has four cases. Most attorneys have 400 cases. Some may have 4,000 cases. But all of the attorneys' cases, the attorney's entire litigation portfolio in the state trial courts will be here so they can hyperlink up and open up all of their court files relating to their particular cases. And those can be ordered by the attorney in terms of jurisdiction, in terms, you know, alphabetically, case type, what have you. The last section that we have for the attorneys is called My E-Notifications. Courts, as you know, issue a lot of notices, notice of trial, notice of hearing, minute orders, judicial orders. Anything coming emanating from the courts relating to a specific file to go out to the parties will be distributed to the lawyers or the registrants, in this case, through e-notifications, because we also have a lot of self-represented litigants, and they're entitled to register as well relating to their cases. So that, briefly, is the attorney portal. Now, perhaps we can go to the Justice Partner portal. there are many justice partners in California, all of whom today are fairly restricted by the limitations of the CLET system, which has some accuracy challenges as well as huge limitations on the kinds of information and the breadth of the information that's provided. So here, a justice partner can sign in through their security clearance and access certain information. In this case, what are we going to search? What do you want to search for, Tony? Okay, we'll search for a person by name. So let's say there's an officer who's in the field. They've got somebody in handcuffs. They have a, what they believe to be a correct ID on them. Other than, you know, calling dispatch, they can now go out to their squad car, open up their laptop, and search this person's cases to see exactly what history there is out there. In this particular case, Jim Jones, there's multiple Jim Joneses, so let's pick one of them. Sure. So this particular Jim Jones has, if you scroll down slightly so we can catch the breadth of all his cases, has five cases, one of which is a dissolution, and five of which are criminal cases. So let's open up one of those criminal cases just to get the kind of information that our justice partners can access in the field or in the probation department or what have you. Okay, so this will open up as to a specific case. It will show you the violations charged. It will give fine information. It will give originating agency information, criminal ID data, and there are a number of menu items in all of these portals, but related to the justice partners, there are specific items for warrants, for jail time associated. There's bail bonds, related cases, register of actions, hearing information, case participants, programs that they're assigned to, diversions, fees and fines, which are payments, victim restitution, prison time. Why don't you jump in there on prison, because that might be of interest to law enforcement officers. So there's all of this information that can be broken down so that when an officer is at a scene or is in the booking room and is consulting with the judge about setting bail, or the probation officer is there, or CDC is processing a prospective inmate, and historically the court file is sort of somewhere on its way, they can have real-time information on everything in that person's court files, and it's hugely helpful. And it's not just the criminal court files. Obviously, if it's a domestic situation, there's family law files that can be accessed, restraining orders, civil harassment orders, those types of things. So the advantage to our justice partners of having this kind of information over and above what I consider a glorified Western Union teletype is profound.
Judge Reeser, before you go on to the judges portal, I know some of the Los Angeles County judges or others leaving for flights might have some questions, and I'd like to get in some questions, and then we'll take up the judges portal after, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
Are there any questions on this?
I had a question for Justice Berniers, but...
Please do.
Justice Berniers, I wanted to know if the Governance Committee has set up a protocol for receiving questions both from the Judicial Council and from judges on various courts with respect to many of the issues regarding CCMS?
Well, as to a protocol, we have not yet. I can say that what we have done is initiated an outreach effort by trying to communicate with the entire branch, at least letting them know who we are, what we're doing. We have invited comments, and I can assure you I have received many, have tried to respond to them. But in terms of a protocol for doing it, no, we have not done that yet. Our focus has been to at least, again, get the message out as to who we are, what we're trying to do, trying to deal with, obviously, the product acceptance issues. So that certainly is an issue that we probably need to address, Judge Wesley.
Well, Judge Wesley and Justice Berniers, I think we talked about this earlier, but in terms of a protocol, it's my intention to create a fifth standing committee to Judicial Council that would be CCMS, so that we would have regular reports to the council from the standing committee, much like you heard this morning from RuPro Rules and Project and PCLC and ENP, so that we can continue to have regular updated reports. And I'll be referring this to Justice Huffman and ENP for the rulemaking to make that happen. That's correct. At least every time we meet, in much the same way that all the other four standing committees. I forgot litigation committee, but they don't report. But CCMS would report regularly, and that's what I envision by making CCMS a standing committee.
And Judge Wesley, the chairs of the different CCMS governments committees have met, and we are open to go anywhere, 800 miles to Orange County or 800 miles someplace I want to fly fish. But, I mean, and I know that we have some meetings set up with the regional centers.
Yeah, we're going to be going to all of the regional meetings as well, and I've already extended offers to a number of the judges who have communicated with me to come to their courts and to present the demonstrations, to give them information. Certainly we have a number of members of the governance committee who are on the Judicial Council here, and we will be responsive to any request from any member of the council at any time.
Thank you.
Well, I have a question for Mr. Moore related to the additional expenses that we're going to be incurring before our next meeting or through the end of this year. Look, there are obviously a lot of significant issues that we have to address that were raised by the audit. I reviewed the audit and do take it seriously, as everyone mentioned, and I'm glad to know that all of these audit recommendations are going to be implemented. One of the recommendations was that the council not spend significant amounts of money on this matter until we've completed the cost-benefit analysis. And I don't think that's been completed yet. We really have to review and consider that. I think the same goes for the independent review that's going to be conducted. What are we looking at? I mean, you mentioned some of the downsides of stopping everything now. But what are we looking at in terms of expense between now, let's say, our next meeting or the end of the year? I understand there's not going to be any money spent on deployment. It's been agreed to that until the independent review is completed, it's not going to be deployed. But as I understand, there's still some development going on. Now, maybe some of that development is necessary for the independent audit to occur, and you can comment on that. But realistically, what's your best estimate of what we know is going to be spent between now and the next meeting? Because, as I said, we have some major issues, one of which is funding, whether it's $1.3 billion or $1.9 billion or whatever the difference is. We have to have some confidence that the money is going to be there. Other issues are the buy-in by all the courts, all these things that were mentioned by the auditor. In the meantime, I understand we have to go forward and fund those operations that are depending every day on the funding for just ordinary maintenance, and I don't think there's any dispute about that. But in terms of additional development costs, what's your best estimate?
So, as I said, the development is $25.4 million this year, of which we've already expended $5.1. I would expect, and many of the contracts are deliverables-based, meaning the payments don't occur until after the particular deliverable is completed and signed off on, and then has to go through the normal process, including going to the state controller's office. So it's a little hard to specifically or give you a particular burn rate because there are too many variables. But I could say that, you know, a significant portion of the remaining $25.4 million will be expended because we will have accepted the product or about to accept the product if everything goes to plan, the core product, by the time you meet next April. So I would, as I've said earlier, I would expect that if we were to wind this thing down or put it on pause, as we said, we would expend more than we have now in the budget to do that. So
You're saying it would be a greater expense than what you would otherwise be spending on development?
That's
that
correct.
What you're saying?
That's correct. And I should say, too, to clarify, just so, because I don't want any misunderstanding in the committee, the agreement or what BSA said is do not start to deploy. They did not tell us, and they were very specific when they said, we're not telling you to stop. We're not telling you not to move forward with the planning and the preparations for deployment at those three early courts. So there is a budget for deployment this year to support those activities, and those activities would continue.
I understand.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
There is
you
that budget,
that there
but
would
still
be no
subject,
money.
It is still subject to the council's discretion.
Oh, correct.
Yes, but that's why I'm trying to find out how much it is.
Sorry. That's correct. I just wanted to make sure because you had said that I believe, if I had heard you correctly, that we were not going to spend any money and that the council has already approved, subject to review and reconsideration, a budget which includes a deployment component.
The larger budget context is important to keep in mind, Judge Pines, that in the conversations that we've had around how do we come up with statewide funds from courthouse construction funds, from CCMS, $10 million, and a variety of other things to offset the cuts to the courts. If that budget deal holds in place, there should be adequate mitigation to the courts in terms of the budget process. So CCMS is already on record as committing $10 million for next year to help offset those cuts to the courts.
And I think it's important to note that we're in product acceptance testing, which really means that you are on – the system is really, for all intents and purposes, completed and done. And so to kind of stop and disband everybody, you'd really be shelving an incomplete, almost ready product. And so I think there are some implications that you may want to consider there as well. Come April, and by the end of this fiscal year, you'll have a fully complete case management system that's ready for a court who's in distress. You'll have an option that you don't have today, subject to funding, I understand.
Judge So?
Before there's actual deployment of anything, Ron, am I correct that that will come before the Judicial Council?
Of course. And then the planning for the first deployments is for the end of 2012 anyway. So, it's not imminent that we're going to go out and turn CCMS on somewhere.
Any more questions from the judges? You may have to leave. I understand 1:30 is the departure time.
Dave, what's your situation? You're okay.
Okay. Okay, then I'm going.
Perfect.
Okay, good. I'm going to ask Judge Reeser. Sorry for the interruption.
No problem.
Have you proceed?
Thank you.
And any questions are solicited, so feel free to ask questions. One important caveat relative to the Justice Partner portals: these are usable by all of Justice Partners. When we talk about cost to Justice Partners, we're talking about creating data exchange standards with their system so that they can provide information that populates our system and vice versa, so that the usability of our cost of running the system and getting information to our system would be improved by having our justice partners using the same data standards. So understand that every cop in the field will have access to this in every county where CCMS is employed, and also in other counties where it's not employed, they can still go on and see what's going on in the CCMS counties. Like if there's someone in Santa Barbara County and they come up, they ID somebody who's from Ventura County, they might know that they can go online and run CCMS Ventura and find all the Ventura information about this particular individual before we roll out to all the counties. Tony's going to now bring us to one of our judge portals, and this is a judge's criminal calendar. So it's very similar to what Bob showed us in civil. This is the final product version of what is a criminal. This is a probation violation calendar and an arraignment calendar. And so this would be just your general calendar that you'd walk in the morning. So let's just go into one of those cases, Edward Jones. So most judges have now what we call case information sheets. And this is the snapshot of this particular case. So relating to Edward Jones' case, there's some general information on the probation status, the probation start and stop date, the calculations for revocation reinstatement, the charges relative to this alleged probation violation. And so a judge, without drilling down, would get some very accurate information about why this particular case is on calendar. But to actually get into the file, you would just drill down one time, and you open up Mr. Jones' file. And there's personal information. Perhaps if you could click on Edward Jones. Right. We had to borrow a photograph for this one. But there's specific information, CMS ID number, CII numbers, specific information, addresses. There's AKAs on a lot of these. And so that information is available. But getting back to the case itself, you see that in this particular case, the menu items are charges and priors, and so it hyperlinks to the code section for, in case we have that aberrational code section that we don't recognize, because, you know, in criminal courts, it's all about numbers. And you can view all the priors. There's attorney information. So if you wanted information on various attorneys, that's available. There's probation information as to this probation, and all the related documents. So why don't you, right there, there's an icon for the probation violation. Is that open up, Tony? Okay, all right. The past probation violations in this case, there's current sentence and sentencing history. There is custody calculations. And this is, of course, the bane of all most criminal trial judges' existence, is calculating credits. It's going to be done electronically for us, whether it's a 15% state prison, whether it's 50% state prison, whether it's two-thirds county, whatever it is, those types of calculations will be made available through CCMS, so you don't have to send it back to probation umpteen times till they can make time to actually do the credit calculations. Fees and fines are going to be real-time listed here, so you know the current balance. Not a lot of our clients always know the exact balance. Victim restitution information is available, criminal protective order information. These are just menu items, programs that someone's assigned to. In this case, there aren't any, but it could be DV classes, what have you. Diversions, warrants, which are critical because a lot of times there's an FTA, you know, and you want to see what the warrant is, where it's generated, what the charge is, not just in your jurisdiction, but in any law enforcement jurisdiction in the state, past and future hearings. And here is the big one in my mind. Actually, there's other cases in this county which aren't related to probation violations, past cases that may have closed, cases that don't have probation. And then there is other cases out of county. Okay, so for those suspects and criminal defendants who don't honor county jurisdictional boundaries, there are data fields available so that we can not only access their cases, but also there is so much rich information that other counties have. You know, the millions, if not billions of dollars put into the probation departments to do these collateral contacts and write these very extensive family histories. It would be really nice to actually know something about someone that's been that well documented, as opposed to looking at a CLEPS report and say, okay, well, you know, I'm guessing this 270 days is an appropriate sentence for this felony. So that information is available. Other cases, many people are involved in our system in many ways. And so if there are dependency cases, delinquency cases, family law cases, civil cases, they'll be listed here. Related documents to this particular hearing. So as it relates to the probation violation hearing, as a shortcut, we've culled out the most important documents. There are certain appointments, CDA, what have you, and then, or 730 expert, and then pending e-filing. So that, in a nutshell, quite tersely, is a judge's criminal trial court screen. And perhaps briefly we can run through civil, because we actually have screens which have been evolved through subject matter experts and judges in criminal law and in juvenile delinquency and in juvenile dependency and in civil and in probate, mental health, and in small claims. And this is civil. So this is the V4 version of the final product version of what Bob showed us. where this is a – actually, he's already drilled down from the judge's calendar into a specific case. That's okay. And then, for example, open up the complaint, if you would, please. It's up. There's an icon up top there. Just to the left. Keep going. There you go. Okay, it's not live. Okay. So the kind of information that's available through our civil screens, filing summary, pending events, minute orders and rulings, motions and filings, related cases, ADR information, sanction history, case milestones, appointments in civil matters. Oh, and there's also family law screens. I'm sorry I left that out, too. We have separate family law screens relating to the idiosyncrasies of our very complex family law courts. And so these screens are different, but they look similar because we have a lot of counties where judges do everything, and both they and their staffs have to be conversant in all of these systems. And so to have software that looks very similar across the various case types is going to make it a lot easier for them to manage these calendars where you will have a family law case followed by a criminal case followed by a probate case followed by whatever, so a dependency case. So this is okay. So this is, we're actually moving back out a little bit. This is a judge's civil calendar. Okay, and so there's obviously a lot of screens we can show you. There's a lot of data which is available through these screens. I've just highlighted what they will look like to show you how user-friendly they are, how easy it's going to be for a judicial officer to scroll down. There are, I don't know if you saw those earlier, there's a litany of menu items that all revolve around running an electronic courthouse, you know, taking fees, processing cases, getting them electronically filed. V4, of course, all the orders will be signed electronically by the judges with electronic signature and then pushed out electronically through the system. Proposed orders will be filed, not lodged, and received as such. So there are some procedural changes associated with electronic case management. And, of course, we have a lot of work to do with both the CCP and the rules of court to accommodate the technology and vice versa. So any questions about the final product? Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to show it to you. Obviously, I'm excited about it. Ventura is an early adopter, and we're anxious to get started and to show everyone how easy it is. Will be to use, and hopefully, you know, 2 years from now, I'll be showing you what Bob has showed you, how to go live with the final product in criminal cases and in family law cases, and how it's already been populated in our system, and how easy it will be to roll out to other courthouses.
Judge, is there any interaction with any of your justice partners in Ventura in terms of what their reaction is?
Or? Oh, well, absolutely. In Ventura, our justice partners are very involved in the process. We have continued meetings. They are anxious to, obviously, to receive the kind of information that we've shown. And so the only question is with respect to cost, and we're working on those items right now in terms of how they need to budget to allow themselves to actually receive the information and transmit information to us electronically, not only from the DA's office, but from the Sheriff's Department and from the various local law enforcement agencies. So, no, we're very integrated to begin with, so that's helpful to us. But we have very cooperative law enforcement folks in Ventura County, at least, who are anxious to move forward with CCMS.
And Greg Totten, who's the district attorney in Ventura County, is a member of our governance committee, one of our justice partners.
Excellent. Baxter?
Yeah, great presentation.
Thank you, Justice Baxter.
Very supportive. I recall when I was in private law practice, we would recommend to clients, rather than executing a will or in addition to executing a will, execute a trust, because that way you maintain the privacy of your property and public wouldn't have access to it. And I recognize that this does not make what was private information public information. It retains it as being public, but it's so much more accessible now. So my only question is, do you anticipate any effort to resolve civil cases outside the court system simply because of the information being so accessible?
Actually, a really good question and a philosophical question. But I think societally, when you have hard-to-get information that you make easy-to-get information, it's going to have some impact. So to the extent people want their issues to be resolved without a lot of scrutiny, then clearly counsel would advise them to do it outside the system. I mean, there are some other questions that I think we need to address as a branch as to what types of documents we might not want to have easy to access, and what kind of documents we do want to have easy to access. You know, civil cases, they're very public documents, and there's not a lot of privacy typically associated with those. But family law cases are very sensitive. And we do have certain case categories that are already not available to the public, but there are parts of conservatorship files that are public. Guardianship files are public, other than the confidential portion. So as a branch, we obviously will have to come to grips with that. But in terms of the hardware and the software being able to accommodate public access, it's here.
Justice Baxter, I might just comment. If you recall, a few years ago, we enacted rules of court, which were controversial at the time, about remote electronic access to court files. And as a policy matter, the council decided that we would not allow remote electronic access to at the document level, beyond the docket, to certain case types, family among them, probate, mental health, domestic violence, cases of that sort, in order to maintain the practical obscurity of the documents. One of the advantages to this system is it will allow people to get information, for example, on a family law matter as to their own case, but that a neighbor could not get, for example. And this system allows us to put security and privacy at the document level that we can't do now. So you can make documents confidential in this system as well. And one of the other things that we're trying to build into our document management system is some automated redaction software to ensure that personal identifiers aren't published when this information is available online. So I think what V4 allows us to do is provide even better levels of privacy and security than we have today and under our public access rules.
Justice Berniers is vice chair to Justice Chin of the Court Technology Committee, and that committee really has been looking at this issue for a long time and will continue to, as you know, having documents and files available from anywhere in the world, and how that sort of changes the nature of what's a public document is something that is open for further debate.
Ms. Krinsky and then Judge O'Malley.
I think my question, Mark, is probably more directed to you or maybe Ron, and it relates to the timing of the independent audit vis-a-vis the final product acceptance testing and sort of reaching that moment in time when the product is deemed accepted. And I guess the question, I recognize that the independent audit is a costly thing in a time when no one has money to burn. But I do think it was the prudent thing to do. I think it was an important thing to come forward and agree will happen. I guess what I'm trying to gain a sense of is, will the independent audit be completed, we expect, before the final product testing is completed? And if not, would there be any implications vis-a-vis our contractor, vis-a-vis Deloitte, by accepting the product at the completion of final product acceptance, such that if the independent audit determined that there were other things that would cause us with 2020 hindsight not to want to have accepted the product, that we'll no longer, vis-a-vis Deloitte, be able to do in the same way by virtue of having accepted the product. Does that make sense?
It does. And, okay. And there are actually a couple of questions in there, and they're good ones.
Feel
Thank you for that.
Feel free to thread them out.
No, so I'll thread them out. First of all, as far as what the independent review, because it's really a review of, they're going to lift the hood, if you will, and take a look at the insides and make sure they were put together well.
And some of us are as bad with cars as we are with computers. So, yeah.
And so the first question is an interesting one. What if we were to run it in parallel with that testing? And what if we could do that? They would actually be lifting up the hood while we were changing things. So they wouldn't really be reviewing the end product.
Okay.
What Payson, the technical expert, really said is that you went in and you had to extend the development by 9 months because you had 50,000 errors. In the very first wave of that first wave of integration testing, and basically it looked like the application was coming undone. You have to put those 50,000 errors, I would say, having seen many, many of these large complex, and people kind of cringe when I say that 50,000 errors don't scare me. It scares me if the developers and the people who are supposed to fix that application don't understand how they got there and how to get out. This is a very complex application. Payson, to get back, said, you're going to fix those 50,000 errors, which they did in the deep dive, which I talked to you about. Then you're going to go through and you're going to do your integration testing and you're going to do your product acceptance testing. But what happens if you get through all that and it functions and we look under the hood and it's basically put together with baling wire, right? If they would run parallel and try to do that, not only if they found something, it would be a moving target. Contractually with Deloitte, we've set up criteria that we've agreed to for acceptance of the application. So if they are able to complete that application to a quality of 0050,
right.
If they were to pass those stringent stress tests, which I will tell you was the main reason why I was telling Ron that I would find it very, very difficult for that sort of independent review to come up with huge issues if you're meeting your stress test requirements, because the stress test, if the system wasn't put together all that well and you stressed it, bad things should start to happen, and so that's another indication there. But contractually, if they found something, we wouldn't have a mechanism necessarily to tell them within the product acceptance test to do it. We would during the warranty period. So what you really want to do is you want to have a completed product that we agree to and that we've accepted, and then you bring the independent review in to look under the hood, check things out, and if they find items that are of a concern, and I believe what they really want to do is let the branch know that maybe if this application wasn't fixed correctly, it's going to cost you an awful lot to maintain it, to expand on it, and so the total cost of ownership would go up. We would have a mechanism within the warranty period to address that with Deloitte and say, you know, you really need to fix this particular issue and you need to make the code comply with whatever they find. There will be findings, and I've talked to folks about it, and whenever you have an independent review, every developer, consultant group will come with their own methodology, their own thought processes, and their own opinions. And so often in an application like this, if you have five different groups, you're going to have five different methodologies and five different opinions on many different things. The real question is when you get these findings, you have to work with them very closely and analyze them and say, are they material? So we all got to the finish line. Just because they would have got to the finish line taking a different path, is that meaningful? Does it mean that it was done incorrectly and that it's going to cost the branch more money or expose the branch to risk or make the application more vulnerable from a security perspective? Those are things we have to pay attention to. What I want to make sure we are able to do is have a meaningful dialogue with the OCIO and the BSA for these findings to really say, what type of finding is it and is it really material? So
Mark, I understand all that. Now it makes more sense. Can I just ask
sure.
one? Very short clarifying question. So if I understand it, the ordering is first the product acceptance testing ends, and then, as you said, the hood is, you know, stationary. What's under the hood is stationary, so an independent review at that point makes sense. The warranty then kicks in.
Right.
So if there are defects under the hood, it's under warranty. But in light of that, so when does that likely mean that the independent review would start? And when does it likely mean the independent review would end? Because I've heard the presumption by individuals that the independent review will be done within 60 to 90 days. But what you've just explained doesn't sound to me like that's really a reasonable presumption.
And I think the misunderstanding is sort of the length of time of the activity. So the activity, when we estimated, we came up pretty much with the same thing that the BSA did, you know, 6 to 9 week activity. I think they said 6 to 10 or 6 to 8, roughly the same, about $500,000 effort. It's really when it starts.
Right, but it won't be ready to start
July.
Until...
End of July.
Acceptance testing is done, and that we think will be July.
End of July, correct. Okay. But we'll work. Go ahead.
So for those who have raised the concern that we sort of freeze things, for those of us who have assumed that that would only mean freezing things for 60 to 90 days, really that's not accurate. If we were to freeze things, we'd be looking at freezing things for many months until the independent review is done, correct? Well, you know, or whatever freezing might mean.
But we can't even start the independent review until we finish the acceptance.
Until June or July. So we're looking well into the fall, if not the end of the year, before the independent review would be done. Right?
Correct.
Judge O'Malley?
Thank you. Having handled a busy criminal calendar, I can tell you that I've had to continue many matters because I didn't have the information that this V4 will give to me at my fingertips. So I thank you, Judge Reeser, for such a wonderful demonstration, and Judge Moss for the V3. I'm very much looking forward to being able to have access to information like this, and I can see how valuable it will be to judges on the bench while they are hearing their calendars. You know, not having to wait for a file, or usually it's putting the matter over and having all the parties come back at another time to be able to resolve the simple issue of what's going on with the probation matter. So I thank you for that very much.
I would
like to just point out a couple of things, and especially over the conversations that have been going on the last couple of days and conversations that I've had with the legislators, and that is that obviously this body is willing and wants to now take responsibility and ownership over this process until it's completed and until it's successfully, you know, given to all the other courts for us to be able to use. I know that we've started this governance process, and Justice Berniers, thank you very much for standing up to be in charge of that process, and I know of your technical abilities, you having been the techie on my bench for many years, and so I know we're in good hands in that regard. If you may, I know that you have several different committees that are set up under your governance structure, and I know we do have some materials in our that we've received, you know, outlining that in a nutshell. And then, Chief, I've heard you this morning tell us, or this afternoon, that we're going to have a report that's going to be given to us as to the progress and status of CCMS at every meeting that we have, if not, you know, if we need it before.
Right, because there will be a CCMS standing internal committee.
So here's a couple of things that I would ask that be provided by those reports. Just jotted down a few of those, and for those reports, it'd be nice to know the activities that have gone on from now until that next meeting, any progress, problems, and status on the schedule would be very nice, the budget plans, expenditures, and any changes in those that we foresee, I think would be very important for this committee to be apprised of, and also any action that's been implemented to comply with the audit recommendations, and any additional steps that you feel we can do over and above those recommendations as given to us by the audits, that we feel we can do more to be able to hold accountable to the public and to everybody that's involved, that this process, obviously it's well worth it. The product is golden. There's no question about that, but to make sure that the process is something that we can be proud of and be held accountable for, and to know to the legislatures and to the public that their tax dollars are being well spent and supervised in the way that the courts would normally operate. So I would ask that for those next reports, that those items be included so that this body can be fully apprised of, you know, the status and take ownership and make recommendations if any need to be to those committees. And again, Justice Berners, thank you and your fellow committee chairs for taking on that responsibility.
Thank you. Justice Miller.
I wholeheartedly agree with setting up the CCMS Executive Committee as a standing committee and with the direction that, that Judge O'Malley has given. We've all read the audit report. I know, Justice Berners, you're very familiar with it, and one of the concerns in there was the oversight. And I'm just wondering how you envision that the committee that has been created will fulfill the recommendations that were outlined in the audit report.
Well, as I said, our first objective is to restore some credibility to the process, and that's to, one, make sure that we share with the branch all of the information on a current basis. Going forward on this, as somebody said the other day, I think that Mark and I are going to be joined at the hip for a while in terms of making sure that Mark has the direction that he needs from us and that we have the information we need from him. The one of the issues we're trying to address is certainly, you know, we've tried to make the Governance Committee broad and inclusive. It also makes it a little unwieldy, but I think getting the active participation, the input from as many of the trial courts as possible is a critical part of the process. I think making sure, as Judge Wesley said, that we're able to receive and respond to the questions both from the council and from the bench as a whole as to what we are doing. I think those are the necessary first steps, and getting the product proven and established here. I think the biggest challenge is going to be, particularly with very uncertain budget situations, what we can do in terms of an implementation plan. I think what we have on what we've had on paper so far is essentially out the window, and we're starting fresh, looking at how we're going to be able to implement this on a statewide basis with what are going to continue to be limited resources. On the other hand, we've seen that. We spend money not doing anything. We spend money trying to maintain the status quo. Those are funds that we probably could spend far better into looking at some creative ways to leverage the resources we have to maximize the rollout and implementation of CCMS. So I think getting the information out to the branch first and foremost, and outside the branch to our colleagues in the legislature as well, and then to establishing the validity and vitality of this product, and then to trying to look at what we can realistically do within a reasonable time frame to make this available to all the trial courts.
Justice Berners, as chair of the Executive Committee for CCMS, then, you've heard the cost-benefit analysis that was presented to us earlier. And so I wanted to know if you had any comments on that and ideas about where it should go as chair of the Executive Committee.
In terms of the cost-benefit analysis, I said I think, you know, there are certain things that I think the cost-benefit analysis confirmed what we perhaps intuitively knew in some areas, but the major concern is trying to maximize that return on investment that we have made. My own view is that the product that we now have fully justifies the investment we have made into the development, and that if we fail to use that product and fail to implement the CCMS in as many courts as we can, then we have failed to recognize the return on investment that's available to us. I think that you know, we need to make sure that we can, as a matter of fact, get that toward the most optimistic case to maximize those returns. But I think there are expenses that the courts would otherwise have, money that we would otherwise have to spend on short-term solutions that we can perhaps apply to CCMS. I think there are ways we can certainly reduce some of these costs by letting the courts, the trial courts, know what they need to do to prepare for implementation, obviously, ultimately, the implementation strategy, the rollout strategy, is going to be for this council to decide. I don't think we have a we do not have a firm recommendation to make to this to the council at this time, but that will be one of our priorities in coming back to the council, is saying what makes some sense, what can we do to leverage the limited resources we have, and what are the alternatives that the council can consider in terms of a rollout strategy.
Is there a motion then to move the cost-benefit analysis to the executive committee, Judge Pines?
That executive
committee.
Yes, so moved.
Second. Second by Judge O'Malley. All in favor?
So is that executive committee the same as the committee, Chief, that you've referenced?
No. There is an executive committee, and I will be appointing the CCMS committee shortly.
A separate CCMS.
That's correct. There'll be substantial overlap, of course, but it's an internal committee requiring judicial council membership.
Okay. Would it make sense for them both to be considering, or the executive committee will feed to that other
That's
committee?
That's correct.
Okay, that will be the channel.
Thank you.
Okay.
So in light of that comment, any no's, any opposition? And so moved, and we'll expect a report on the cost-benefit analysis as soon as that's available, and hopefully promptly. It's factually dense. We understand that.
We will try to be back the next meeting with that, Chief.
Thank you, Justice Breniers. Thank you for all that you do. I appreciate the panel's presentation, Mr. Moore, Judge Reeser, Judge Moss. Thank you, Ron. Thank you, Penny. We conclude today's meeting with a brief remembrance
of
judicial colleagues recently deceased.
I didn't know we were concluding. I thought maybe this is not necessary, but there have been some agreements made, I understand, on the part of the AOC as to what was going to occur or not occur. And I thought maybe these should be, in a sense, institutionalized with the direction from the council as a whole. I mean, for example, that there's not to be any deployment, even in the early adopter courts, until this independent review is done. I realize that's been agreed to, but it seems to me that the council ought to go on record as saying, yes, that's correct, that all of the recommendations of the audit should be complied with, and we'll want the committee to oversee that and report back on the compliance with those recommendations. I just feel that the council should make it clear that this is the council's direction as well.
And I think that's right, Judge Pines, but it is a, in my view, given the governance structure that is in place and affirmed, we will wait to hear back for confirmation. But I don't think anyone thinks that AOC is moving forward on any of this. And I'll expect a report back from the CCMS Standing Committee, which is fed by the Executive Committee and the four advisory committees, for that information in April.
Okay.
So as I was saying, we conclude today's meeting with a brief remembrance of judicial colleagues recently deceased, all are retired, and I'd like to name them. They are Associate Justice Hugh Evans, Court of Appeal, 3rd District, Judge David Eisenson, Superior Court of California, County of Los Angeles, Judge Mason Fenton, Superior Court of California, County of Orange, Judge Rothwell Mason, Superior Court of California, County of Sacramento, Judge E. Warren McGuire, Superior Court of California, County of Marin. Judge Franklin Orfield, Superior Court of California, County of San Diego. Judge Donald Thorne, Municipal Court of California, County of San Bernardino. Judge Juanita Varon, Municipal Court of California, County of Los Angeles. And we honor them for their service to their courts, to the cause of justice, and to California. And I thank you all for traveling to Sacramento through the storm for this session and other meetings this week. And when we convene our next business meeting on April 29th at the Judicial Council Conference Center in San Francisco, we hope budget negotiations will be near complete. We'll have an update, more information for you, and more information on